he has expertise on mitigation as well, working with California, in California, on cuts to carbon emissions. And she also chaired a task force on geoengineering for the Bipartisan Policy Think tank. And so we'll ask her to talk not only about mitigation and her experience, but also about geoengineering pros and cons. Doug Beard, a biologist and chief of the USGS National Climate Change and Wildlife Science Center in Reston, Virginia. And he there directs the science activities of 8 Interior Department climate science centers, which focus on the science of adaptation in natural areas. So we'll ask him to talk about some basic principles and some real-world cases for the areas he's responsible for. We did have a fourth panelist. I apologize. Alex Washburn is listed in the printed program. He's not here, not able to make it. He was going to talk about urban resilience, so I'll try to fill in my role as a journalist covering adaptation strategies in New York City. By the way, my name is Adam Glenn. I should have said that, I suppose. But so I'll try to fill in a bit, but we'll certainly look for expertise in the room and on the podium on that issue to fill that gap. So let's get started. We'll start with Emmanuel. Each speaker is just going to take about 5 minutes or so to set the table for our discussion to follow. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, and very happy to be with you all this morning. I'm not going to speak French, even though we're in the New Orleans, but do my best to give you my remarks in English. Thank you very much for the kind introduction. I'll very briefly give you a few words about what I think is a very exciting and important project, which you mentioned, the Deep Decarbonization Pathways Project, but very much looking forward to questions after that. It's a project that we're doing to support the climate negotiations in the context of the UN Convention on Climate Change. So we're hoping for a successful agreement to be reached in Paris in December 2015. And what I think is really important about the project is that this is the very first time that it gathers some of the leading research institutions on energy and climate change, because the focus is on energy-related greenhouse gases emissions from the 15 largest emitters of greenhouse gases. So we have teams from 15 countries participating to the project. These are all the large developed and emerging economies, so the US, China, India, South Africa, Canada, Australia, Europe, of course, Russia, very interestingly. And I think this is a pretty big step forward, because so far we had mainly results from global scenarios telling us, yes, this is feasible to achieve deep decarbonization consistent with the objective of limiting the increase in temperature below 2 degrees Celsius. So these scenarios, for example, reviewed in the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or scenarios produced by the International Energy Agency. But really, my view would be that they were not granular enough to be convincing at the country level, which is really where the key decisions need to be made. And well, to make a more political point, I mean, they were really not owned by experts or policymakers in these countries, so really not possible to have a policy or a political discussion on these scenarios so far. We're trying to make this change, and we have already published a report in advance of the climate summit that will take place in New York on September 23rd. So we've issued the report to the Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon. I really encourage you to go and read the report. It's a fun report in spite of its size, I'm sorry. But it's available online on the website deepdecarbonization.org. And let me tell you just a few words about it. One is, we've tried very hard to avoid the issues that have blocked the climate negotiations so far, because we really wanted to make a research contribution and a substantive contribution to the policy debate. So instead of arguing forever, the way we've done in the past, and I was part of these discussions about how to share equitably the global carbon budget, we've said, I mean, let's try really hard and together to achieve the deepest possible level of decarbonization in all our countries. And we've made a number of assumptions to make that possible, and it's in fact both an assumption and one of the very important results of the report. I mean, all the teams to achieve these very deep level of decarbonization consistent with the 2-degree limit said, we assume that the world is going to be serious about 2-degree and is going to invest massively into some of the key technologies that are necessary to do that. And we came up with a list of technologies and gave timeline for the deployment of these technologies and also discussed the learning curve for the cost of these technologies. So I'm talking about carbon capture and sequestration. I'm sure we're going to discuss more about that with the next panelist, but the teams assumed that where there is geological potential in their country, so it's not everywhere. For example, that was not the case in India, not the case in Japan, but where there is geological potential for storage, CCS could be deployed. Same for nuclear forced generation in countries where the teams felt like there would be political support for that particular technology. We assume that energy storage would become available and would enable the management of power systems with very high shares of intermittent renewable energies, and so on and so on. So a very practical way of looking at things, and I'd be happy to respond to questions as to which technologies in particular were important in some countries. I mean, the truth is, if you look at the results, that each and every pathway in these countries is built on the same three pillars. So it is energy efficiency first, and very importantly, probably important, by the way, to distinguish in between technical energy efficiency, so the improved efficiency of equipment or appliances, and what I would call structural energy savings. So different urban designs, for example, or material switching, more structural changes, but leading to less energy consumed per unit of GDP produced. So that's one. The second, of course, and very importantly, is the production of electricity with low carbon energy sources. So in all these scenarios, and it's really impressive, the power sector, which is the first source of emissions in most of these countries today, turns to be almost zero emitting by 2050 because electricity is produced through renewable energies or fossil fuels plus carbon capture and sequestration or nuclear. And it's very interesting to see that the teams have picked up different options to do that. So, for example, in the Canada pathway, the team put a lot of fossil fuels plus carbon capture and sequestration. None of it, as I said, in the Indian scenario, because the team told us we're very uncertain about the potential for geological sequestration in our country, so we're not going to put it. No nuclear at all, I guess not a surprise, in the scenario that was produced by Germany. Some nuclear in the scenario produced by France, but also by most of the country teams. By the way, certainly some in the US, a lot in China, some in India, etc. So, and I should also say that some teams have chosen not to produce only one pathway, but a set of pathway, sometimes with high share of renewable energy, high share of nuclear energy, high share of fossil fuels plus CCS, because it is very true that it's not only an issue for experts, and that the public has to make decisions. So we've tried to present the results of these alternative pathways, all of them achieving the same emission reduction objective, in a way that enables a public discussion on these issues. Let me conclude by saying that, again, since we're discussing about, you know, the technicalities and the possible solutions, it is very clear that some technologies that are not yet available today or at too high cost or still not really reliable will need to be deployed and sometime pretty quickly to achieve the climate mitigation objectives. I listed a few: CCS, in my view, energy storage for sure, long-range electric vehicles. They play a very big role in all of the scenarios. Second-generation biofuels, also in some countries, but very important to make sure that they're produced in a way that is not leading to deforestation or competing with land use for food production, for example. So it is very true that a carbon price is absolutely necessary to make sure that these technologies are developed, but it will not be sufficient. We will need some kind of public-private partnerships, directed, accelerated technical change. The market forces alone are not going to be enough to deploy these technologies at scale and on time. We've got, I think, a lot of interesting examples in other sectors, like what happened in the semiconductor industry or what happened with genomics. And I think this is really what we need to apply to the energy systems today. So I'll stop here, looking forward to questions, and please go to the deepdecarbonization.org website to read the report. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm not going to speak French either. So I want to talk to you first just a little bit about mitigation, and I applaud Manuel's efforts. I think we really need this. I led an effort in California to do the same thing just for the state, and it was extremely difficult. We had a very high-level committee, Nobel Prize winners. Actually, Steve Chu started out on the committee and then became the Secretary of Energy, and was just extremely well thought out in terms of trying to understand a simple question. In California, the governor had created an executive order that said that in 2050 we would have 80% reduction in emissions below 1990 levels, which is about a 90% per capita reduction. And we just wanted to know one thing: can we do it? Is there technology extant today that could do it? So we set up a process of accounting and evaluating technology for its feasibility to use in a model that would count emissions. And we counted very carefully. We counted things only once, and we counted everything. And when we did that, and we didn't leak, we tried very hard not to leak our problem to somewhere else. For example, you know, the city of San Francisco has a plan to reduce emissions by 20% by 2020, and one of the ways they're doing it is to stop selling Hetch Hetchy power to other entities. That's a hydroelectric plant. So those other entities are just building gas-fired plants to do their electricity. We tried very hard not to do that and not to take more than our fair share of resources. So we established four steps. Those four steps were: one, to make things as efficient as we could. We changed every single square foot of building in the state of California. We either tore it down, built it to new standards, or retrofit it. That's an enormous step. I mean, it's just not going to happen. We made everything as thermodynamically efficient as we possibly could. We electrified everything that we possibly could, because under the assumption that electricity is easier to decarbonize than mobile fuels. And then we looked at how we could decarbonize electricity, which is the key step. Everyone thinks efficiency is the key step. The key step is building electricity that doesn't create emissions, because you can be as efficient as you want, and if you're still making your electricity with coal, you're going to have emissions. But if you're making all your electricity without carbon dioxide, then if you have to make a little bit more, it doesn't matter as far as the emissions go. So that's the single most important step. And then we looked at how we could decarbonize the remaining need for fuel. Meanwhile, the amount of energy we had to produce was twice what we're producing today. So what we found, in a nutshell, was that we didn't have the technology to go all the way. That technology just simply doesn't exist. And the major reason it doesn't exist is not what people think. It's because we can't get rid of the need for fuel in society, and the amount of biofuels that are likely to be available is a small fraction of what we need. And furthermore, even if we do use biofuels, it's not clear that they'll be decarbonized. So with that, we have a picture then of energy, which is going to be extremely difficult. And I would challenge Emmanuel to be sure that he counts everything, counts it once, and doesn't leak in all of these plans, because I think when you do that, you will find that it's not quite so optimistic. Nevertheless, there's a lot we can do, and we should be doing it. What we also found in the electricity sector is that there are basically three ways to do it. You can do nuclear power, you can do renewable energy, and you can do fossil fuel burning with carbon capture storage underground. All of these methods have problems, every single one of them. Nuclear power is the only one where technically we know how to do it, and it's actually really decarbonized, but it's socially unacceptable in a lot of places. But if you go to Germany and you ask them why they turned down nuclear power, they say it's a climate policy. It's not a climate policy. Nuclear power is the single biggest way to attack the electricity problem. Then there's renewable energy, which is the popular model. But you have to take into account that if you're going to build out this system, you have to have all the parts of it. It's not just the capacity. It's not just putting the plants on the ground. You can't count how many megawatts of plants you have and think you're done. It also has to be reliable, and it also has to be built fast enough. And what we're finding with renewable energy, that the amount of technology we need to make a reliable, low-cost system is still not clear. So we don't have that technology. So what we assumed in our model was that we're going to use natural gas to balance the power. And natural gas is what's happening. People are building natural gas plants because natural gas is cheap and because you can't rely on the power from wind or solar. And the storage at the scale of the utility doesn't exist. So then the final issue would be carbon capture and storage. And here we find that this is an incredibly important technology, not just for electricity, but because in the end, all the different ways we found to make fuel without carbon dioxide, many of them relied on carbon capture and storage. So in the end, we think that the technology is very difficult right now. It's not there. We don't have all the technology we need to solve this problem. We have a lot, and there's a lot we can do. We could get maybe halfway there, and that's a big deal. But even if we got halfway there, if you look at the latest IPCC reports on the most optimistic scenarios for the future, what we're seeing in those reports is by next century, we are requiring geoengineering to stay below 2 degrees. And that is a dramatic change from the last IPCC report. Almost all of these models require that you suck carbon dioxide out of the air or you cool the earth in some way to stay below 2 degrees. If we're talking about staying below 2 degrees, I think we have already lost that battle. Very likely that we have already lost that battle. This is one of the reasons I've gotten involved in trying to get our country to start to do research on concepts related to climate engineering. Now, there are a few concepts out there right now that are have been discussed, but basically, literally no money has gone into physical research. What has happened is there's been a lot of money to think about how to govern this kind of research and the ethical implications, but the ideas, the physical ideas of what you could do, what might work, what might be advisable, what might be feasible, we're only starting. The two major kinds of technologies that have been talked about so far are solar radiation management, which is a technology that came to be thought of because when we get volcanic eruptions that spew sulfuric acid into the stratosphere, into the atmosphere, we find that they reflect sunlight and the following years are cooler, but they're also drier. So we know this is a technology with a lot of problems. The recent IPCC report also contains a very nice study called GeoMap, which is a model comparison of different ways of turning the knobs on solar radiation management to see how well you could do with this technology. And basically what it shows is that on average, on the whole, the Earth would be better off if we got to be unbearably hot that the Earth would be better off on average, but that doesn't mean it would be better off everywhere and in all parameters. And it's not possible to optimize both temperature and precipitation, for example. You can do one or the other. So these technologies are fraught with problems. They're really difficult. On the other hand, we haven't even begun to think about them. The next set of technologies are, oh, let me say one more thing about them, but we also know they wouldn't be that hard to deploy. So one of the other reasons we need to do research is that it's quite possible that other countries will try it, and we should know whether that kind of activity is happening and whether we should be worried about it or how we should be worried about it. Okay, finally, the other kind of technologies are removing carbon dioxide from the air, and those are take a lot of money and take a lot of time, but they're very attractive because they are basically akin to mitigation. They make you feel better because they're not as they may not be as risky. They may be more locally risky. And just to say, these technologies, all these things are just—it's just the beginning. Only last year, a guy came up with the idea of seeding cirrus clouds, so that long-wave radiation, which is what carbon dioxide blocks, could escape the Earth. And that would return the Earth much more evenly to a condition that was closer to what it was before we had so much carbon dioxide in the air. But it wouldn't solve the problem of acidification in the oceans. My point is really that we have to deal with transparency, vested interests, governing this research in a correct way, make sure that we're taking risks appropriate to the problem, and get research started. Thanks.
Good. And just before we hear from Doug Beard, so just a reminder, we are looking at mitigation geoengineering, but now, and as Jane has said or argued, that if the 2-degree limit is not achievable, what next? And Doug will address that, and then we'll open up for questions and discussion.
Great. Thank you. That's exactly the way I was going to segue into this. In fact, I work for the U.S. Geological Survey, and for those of you who don't know what that is, it's essentially the research arm of the Department of Interior. And we don't have any management or regulatory authority or science agency that provides information for the bureaus within DOI and the rest of the federal, state, and tribal governments to help them in their own planning and mitigation, as it were. One of the things that the Secretary mentioned yesterday in her remarks was an initiative that I've had the opportunity to be set up and operate for Interior, which is the Department of Interior's Climate Science Centers. There are eight of them across the nation, and their focus is on providing science to help fish wildlife managers and other Department of Interior managers, reclamation with water management endpoints, and the Park Service with cultural and historical artifacts actually adapt to what's coming. So our main goal is to marry up the science that we can produce to the management needs out on the landscape. And that may seem like something that would be common sense and something that we should have been doing for a long time. Unfortunately, I think there's a checkered history of science, and that science will produce stuff, and every once in a while, management will use it. We're trying to actually work directly with managers to develop science in conjunction so they can actually feed into whatever they're doing, whether it's an adaptation plan, whether it's a mitigation event, whether it's just a long-range plan. We want to make sure that the science the management community needs is actually the science we're doing. And that's not to say that the other science that gets produced or around within the survey or elsewhere isn't great and doesn't make a difference. It's just that our emphasis is really on the applied outcomes. That's really what we're trying to do. The big challenge, however, is sort of the language barrier. And it seems like EAT managers and scientists probably all came through the same general training. We probably came through a university somewhere in biological or physical sciences, and we should know the same vocabulary, but then we diverge. And the first concept is really getting the climate science community to talk to the wildlife science community to talk to the managers in a way that we all know what those words mean. The word vulnerability for a manager means a lot different than it does to a climate scientist than it does to a fisheries or wildlife biologist. And finding that common vocabulary is key. So the way we've been doing this is through something called structured decision making. And it's exactly what it sounds like. It's not some sort of complex scientific term that can't be understood unless you've had differential equations or something, although most of the people that teach us have had differential equations. It's basically working to identify the decisions that the managers need to make and then making the science meet that. And I'll illustrate it real quickly with one example, working in Cape Romaine, a national wildlife refuge out on the Atlantic coast. And we know that sea level rise is going to change that refuge. That's almost a certainty. The problem is land upstream for the wildlife refuge managers managed by the Forest Service, not by Interior, although another federal agency, that's a plus. What does that manager do in terms of planning for 20, 30, 40 years out? For planning for recovery for migratory bird species, for coastal species like sea turtles and others, how are they going to design that refuge in a way that actually assures they meet the mission needs of that agency? And so we've been working very, very closely with our management bureaus to actually identify that science that says this is the location that you should put this sort of structure, and this is the location you should do that sort of work. We were out yesterday, and one of the interesting questions asked was, how do you choose to do a restoration project here versus a restoration project there? Well, that's the point of what we're doing in Cape Romaine. How do you choose to work here versus there? Some places will have better or more impact, or we think they will, based on our science, than other places. And in an era, as the Secretary said yesterday, of constrained resources, we have to make the best choices we can, or we're not going to be as successful as we'd like to be. So I think I'll be fairly brief. The only other thing I'll say about the climate science centers is they're relatively new. They're about 4 years. They were started with this administration in 2010, and they're done in partnership with the university system. And so it's to bring the best federal and university scientists together to solve the challenges that we face. And one other final thing I'll add, and we'll then also add a caveat at the end, is the U.S. Geological Survey has worked for quite some time now, maybe 4, 5, 6 years, on working on both geological and biological carbon sequestration. Some of that work has been published, especially on the biological side. I'm very much less familiar with the geological side. And if you ask me any questions, I'm going to plead the fifth because I know very little about the results of some of that work. But if you're more interested in what we do know about what can be done and what the potential is, you can either come up to me and give me your card and we'll direct you to the right people, experts in the survey, or go to the survey's website. I'm sure you can find some of the results of that work. So I think I'll leave it there and we'll move to questions.
Great. Thank you very much. So I'll just take a couple of minutes again on the urban resilience front, a couple of key points just to round this picture out before we get to questions. So start thinking about what you want to extract from these wise individuals before we leave the room at noon. I think for the last few days, if you've been here at the conference, been hearing a lot about the resilience in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, along the lines of what Doug was saying. You know, resilience is a kind of squishy concept, as one of the panelists noted at the Wednesday workshop on disaster coverage. But if you look, just a couple of simple things. If you look at a city like New Orleans, which 9 years on, if you've taken the time to visit some of the most damaged areas, like the Lower Ninth Ward, where some of us went on a tour on Thursday, you'll see that the devastation is still there, and the rebuilding is a very, very slow process, and it's a very complex process in many ways because of the continued risk, or actually the growth of risk of future floods. Similarly, in New York, where I do my work, you know, almost 2 years since Sandy struck the city, and maybe a year plus since then Mayor Bloomberg issued a massive $19 billion resiliency plan with a couple of hundred recommendations. The city has barely begun to help people rebuild their homes. There was a $1 billion program to rebuild homes called Build It Back. And when Bloomberg left office, not one home had been rebuilt by the city with that funding, and now under de Blasio, 500 homes. And I think there were something like 20,000 applicants in the aftermath of Sandy. So that's one challenge, just making recovery work, but that doesn't even go to the issue of resiliency, how to make the city more climate resilient in future, not just what it was, but what it needs to be. And there's been very little clarity on that issue from within the city, very little action, although one of the most interesting projects worth looking at with another one of these acronyms or catchphrases, Rebuild by Design. So if you haven't heard of this project, it's worth looking at. The HUD set aside $1 billion inviting innovation in resilient design for cities, and they distributed that. It was essentially a contest, and they distributed most of that money in this past June, and several of them, we're talking about $300 million projects, one called the Big U, to create sort of protective areas around the sort of lower half of Manhattan, living breakwater projects using sort of habitats like oyster reefs, et cetera. So that's a focus on resilience, but not from the city. That's more from the national government. The last thing I'll mention also is, in terms of urban resilience, is this issue of whether to rebuild or retreat. As sea level rises, as extreme weather threatens, you know, a greater probability of flooding, do you simply rebuild and make more resilient, or do you back off from the coasts? And the state and the city of New York are at odds on that to some extent. The Governor Cuomo in New York proposed a $500 million, $400 million rather, home buyout program. So far as I recall, one community in Staten Island, which was very badly damaged by Sandy, has applied to be a pilot. And they volunteered, essentially, this sort of existential, we will no longer be here. That's okay with us. We can't take it anymore. So I'll stop there. There's much, much more, obviously, on the urban resilience front, but I want to really leave the time for questions. Any are there questions from the floor yet? Because I'd also invite the speakers, too, to ask questions. There are plenty. So I'll come around and play Oprah here. So one and two. Stand.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This question is for Jane. I'm sorry, my name is Cynthia Barnett. I'm an independent journalist and author, and I write about water, but I've been subscribing to the geoengineering listserv for the past couple of years, trying to understand, you know, trying to keep up. And I'm talking about the scientist listserv, and it's really fascinating if anyone wants to subscribe. I've been trying to understand before I write anything, and it's really tough. And you point out that it's fraught, and we need the research. If we don't do the research, another country may and may deploy technology. But I wanted to ask you, how does one research these enormous, you know, potentially globe-altering technology projects without actually doing it? Are models enough?
Yeah, that's a great question. So recently, over the last year, we organized a couple of workshops to begin to look at what research people would do. And we held a workshop in March at Harvard, and there's a paper coming out about it. If you email me, I can connect you to the paper, where we asked people to just come forward and say, what research should you do right now? And basically, it was not a research program, so it wasn't organized in terms of, you know, here's our strategy. It was just, hey, if there was a place you could go to get money, what kind of proposals would you write? And that was really interesting, because what emerged is that there's the modeling studies we've known about for a long time, and there's a lot of that should be done, and it's inexpensive, and it's very illuminating, and it can help steer you away from things that are clearly really bad ideas. But the models make a lot of assumptions, about physical processes. And oddly, those, for many of the techniques under investigation, those are the same physical processes which climate science is also confused about. So, for example, the albedo, or the ability of clouds to reflect radiation, it's called albedo, that's a very big unknown in climate models. And the role of aerosols, which is what would be used in solar radiation management in the stratosphere to put particles, aerosols, into the stratosphere, the role of aerosols in climate models is very poorly understood. So it turns out that there's this huge class of what we would call intermediate scale, very low risk experiments, which have, where you would, for example, put some sulfur in the, salt particles in the atmosphere, see how they nucleate clouds. And what hasn't been done in climate science is controlled experiments where you put particles that have a known size distribution and a known characteristic and then measure how the clouds form. All of these kinds of experiments are the next step. And we don't know how to take the step to decide whether it would be a good idea to perturb the whole climate yet, but we also don't even know how to take the step to say we're going to do a little bit of cloud brightening or put a little bit of sulfur into the stratosphere and see what happens. We don't have the governance capacity to do that right. So there's some real small baby steps that are the next steps. We're a long way away from something that has to perturb the climate.
Yeah, just a very small follow-up. I think we have a bit of a terminology issue here, because I would certainly put carbon capture and sequestration into a different category than many of the others geoengineering options. In particular, and you said it when you spoke, I mean, in particular, because, I mean, and that's related to your question, you could demonstrate carbon capture and storage somewhere, and the impact somehow would be rather local, which is not the same thing as, you know, the US or China deciding to test the big bazang of, you know, changing the climate, which would have global consequences. So that's really different to me, and also one of the reasons why, I mean, I definitely think that if we don't have carbon capture and sequestration, it's going to be incredibly difficult to stick to the 2-degree limit, that is for sure. In response to your question, by the way, there are some demonstration projects going on, both CCS on power plants or industries, but also interestingly, one of my colleagues at Columbia is testing direct air capture, so diffuse air capture, and it's interesting that you're working on water, because one of the downsides of that particular option is that it is very water consuming. So if you do the math and try to see what it would mean at a global scale, potentially water is a clear downside of direct air capture.
So my question is, Rachel Levin, Bloomberg BNA. My question is along the same lines, actually. You guys were talking about research, and I believe, Jane, you were saying that there's really no way that we're going to have all of the technologies or even half the technologies to prevent us going over this 2-degree limit in time. And so I'm wondering, whose responsibility is it now to really move forward? And this is for any of you on this type of research. Is there a way we can be speeding it up? Should more money be allocated either internationally or by certain nations?
Yes. I think that one of the things about talking about geoengineering, when you start to talk about it, so the moral hazard issue comes up a lot. It was the first thing that came up. If we talk, you know, I don't know if you guys remember, we weren't allowed to talk about adaptation and resilience for a long time because people thought we wouldn't do any mitigation if we did that. And that same issue comes up with geoengineering. If you don't talk about it, you can't talk about geoengineering because there's a moral hazard. People might not do the mitigation we can do, and there's a lot we can do. So I think what is an interesting thing to me is that I think when you start talking about geoengineering, we get the kind of questions that you ask, you know, that people start realizing how big the problem is, how hard the problem is, what kind of strategic approach needs to be taken to the problem. And geoengineering focuses the mind on that, or climate engineering, I should be saying. Climate engineering really focuses the mind on how strategic we need to be about this problem, and that we need to be funding research strategically and taking action on adaptation and resilience strategically. We're like a whole world of blind men and the elephant. And the one thing about climate engineering is it really makes you realize that it is an elephant. So one thing that really makes people understand that.
Yeah, great question. The survey itself is managed in the last few years to maintain a small amount of funding for work both on, mainly on the biological carbon sequestration component. So it's, you know, how do we develop landscapes that might sequester carbon to help with the climate about us. And so one of the projects that we're actually just starting, the first part of this was just doing the basic, what do we know about carbon sequestration in the United States biologically? So just get a baseline. What do we know? What can be done? What's already going on? And now we're actually just starting a project with the Fish and Wildlife Service in the Great Dismal Swamp, where we're actually going out in the landscape and seeing if we can work with the land managers, in this case the Fish and Wildlife Service, to actually implement a carbon sequestration, a biological carbon sequestration strategy on the ground. So when they do their master planning for whatever their management of their refuge, in this case, can they actually do some techniques that better capture carbon biologically as part of their planning? So that project's just starting. I think they've just begun discussions. So that, who knows? Yeah, what results will come soon, we hope. But it's at least a small attempt on DOI's side to try to implement some of the things that we're finding within our own management scale.
Hi, I'm Kristen Olson, and I just finished a book called The Soil Will Save Us that looks at that biological remediation. So, you know, and that looks at that relationship between plants and soil microorganisms that's been taking carbon out of the air and putting it in the soil for a half a billion years. And I know that EDF is involved with, I think, the Marin Carbon Project, which showed that, showed some really powerful emission absorption possibilities just by using compost on rangeland, and they had some figures in terms of how much of California's energy emissions could be absorbed. So I just wondered, how much is that kind of biological remediation part of your thinking, part of your strategy? It's all new science. How much are you looking at it?
Well, I'm not I'm a scientist, but I'm not actually looking at specific techniques. I can tell you that there is a lot of really interesting stuff that could be done with biology. You know, there was a whole period of the geologic history where plants sucked up all the carbon dioxide and we became snowball Earth. You know, so there was a time over, you know, many thousands of years. So the question is, can you understand how that occurred in various places and speed it up? One of the biggest problems we have with all this that people don't, I don't think, have as much of a grasp on as they need to is the time scale. So it's you know, we have a few decades to get on top of this before the impacts are going to be really, really large. And that's really daunting. So I think all of those things are fantastic. We need every single one of them, and then we need some more.
So very much agree that there are some great things that can be done through biology. I mean, lots of interesting fuels that can be synthesized, et cetera, et cetera. So there is great potential, not really doing it. We should be investing more. What I think is not a good idea, and you somehow referred to it in your remarks, is the idea of bioenergy plus carbon capture and sequestration, at least at a large scale. So when you said the latest IPCC report uses geoengineering to reach the 2-degree target, it's because most of the scenarios that reach 2-degree have the global scenarios, and that was also a reason to develop these country scenarios with alternative technologies. But most of the global scenarios use very large-scale bioenergy plus carbon capture and sequestration. So you produce energy through biomass, and then you capture the carbon that is emitted. If you do, I mean, any agriculture engineer would tell you that this is a stupid thing to do at this scale, because, I mean, using so much land to produce energy instead of producing food is completely inconsistent with the need to ensure food security with 9.5 billion of people on the planet by 2050. So there might be niche uses of that particular technology somewhere, but it's really, I mean, it's really the disaster of a climate modeling community really trying hard to reach a particular target using a technology and not looking at the impacts on some other very important issues, such as food security. Again, I mean, I would really challenge everybody saying that 2-degree is no longer feasible. There are some alternative technologies, but that one is a really bad idea, at least at large scale. Yeah, no, sure, no, that was a different comment.
Jan Spiegel from the Connecticut Mirror. My question is basically money. You know, Jane, you said before, you know, if the money was available. Adam, you were talking about RBD, which, you know, actually only gave that money to a few out of 10 finalists, let alone there were something like 140 original applicants. Where's the money coming from? Is anybody doing any kind of economic modeling on how different projects could produce money to, you know, supply these things, provide incentives to have countries, individuals, governments fill in the blank, do this sort of thing? How do we pay for this stuff?
I don't know how to answer that question, but I do want to just use it to segue to a point that I think that journalists, which you are, I gather, should think about and maybe try to write about. I think right now we are losing an amazing opportunity to try to capture the economic engines that exist in the world to help solve this problem. And that is through hydraulic fracturing. I think what we're seeing now, if you look at the EIA estimate of what the least expensive form of reliable electricity is that doesn't produce carbon, it's natural gas generation with high efficiency turbines and carbon capture and storage. That is the lowest price. There is one set of companies in this world that knows how to do all the technology associated with CCS. That's the oil companies. Now, they have made some horrible mistakes in the last couple of decades by not revealing what chemicals they're putting underground, and they've lost their social license to proceed with something that could have been a major impact on climate in this country and the world. Because by producing gas and also producing low-price gas and also sequestering the carbon dioxide, we had a huge opportunity to produce electricity and fuel without carbon dioxide. And we had the industry that knows how to do that, and they are now social pariahs. I think there are engines. If we think climate first, and we don't think ideologically that it's renewable energy or energy efficiency first, but we think climate first, the things that come to the front are CCS and nuclear power. And if you start thinking CCS, it's the oil companies that have the wherewithal, the money, frankly, and the wherewithal to do it. We need to figure out a way to get them to be part of the solution, not part of the problem.
I just want to give a big amen to that little monologue you just had. That was great. My name is Christiana Peppard. I am an interloper to SEJ and have loved being here. I'm a professor at Fordham University, and I work primarily on water scarcity and ethics in an era of climate change and economic globalization. water impacts of climate mitigation and geoengineering strategies, Emmanuel brought up a little bit in terms of water consumptive water use problems. I actually want to go a different direction and say that our focus on carbon makes a lot of sense in terms of climate. In addition, water vapor is a major driver of climate change dynamics. And I wonder if you could outline for us a little bit whether there is research going on in geoengineering, in mitigation sorts of things, with regard to water vapor, which is not often discussed, from what I gather, in those settings.
I'm not sure exactly what you mean. Do you mean predicting what the changes in water vapor would be under different scenarios for active climate engineering?
So yeah, I think that would be one element. But when we talk about geoengineering and mitigation, we talk about compounds that are in the atmosphere or produced by industrial activity that mm-hmm. need to be taken out in some way. And it seems to me interesting that water vapor as it's a very powerful greenhouse gas. So yeah. Is there conversation going on about ways to geoengineer that away, relocate? I mean, this is outside of my purview of expertise, but it's a weird question.
I would say not in terms of engineering it, changing it, but in terms of making sure that you understand how water vapor is behaving in the climate, absolutely. Yeah, that's included in all the global change models that are used to understand it.
I'll use the pause. We do have time for more questions and discussion. If you wanted to add something to that, please go ahead.
I wanted a follow-up on the cost question, which I think is a very important question because it's not only a massive technical challenge, but also obviously a massive financial challenge, and we should recognize it. In the meantime, we very often emphasize the incremental cost compared to business as usual of the climate mitigation scenario, which is important. It's important also to say that it's a good investment strategy because in the long term it pays off, but it doesn't solve the problem of knowing how you pay for it in the short term. I do think that we have a tendency to exaggerate the discussion on the incremental investment cost as opposed to, the total investment need. And there are lots of things that are very costly that we should stop doing in a climate mitigation scenario. I mean, there are billions of dollars invested in drilling more and more profoundly under the Arctic to get oil so it's my point is that it's true that there is an incremental investment cost. It's also true that at the macroeconomic level, it's essentially a question of redirecting investment flows from high carbon projects, etc., to low carbon solutions. So it's essentially a matter of incentives. Pricing carbon is very importantly part of that. Not necessarily, also to generate revenues that can be invested into these projects, but also simply to set the right incentives. In particular, and there are lots of discussions going on the run-up to the climate negotiations in Paris with the institutional investors community, so the pension funds, the sovereign wealth funds, et cetera, because they are the big funders also of these companies working on fossil fuels, and it is a bad investment strategy. So they're trying to make a call, which I hope will materialize by the time of Paris in December 2015, to say we need these investment signals to change the orientation of these investment flows.
Let me ask Doug Beard a question just to help me and maybe others understand what's really at stake here in terms of some of the climate change impacts that you're most concerned about. What kinds of habitat? I mean, I guess there's the obvious, coastal refuges and so on, but maybe there are things we're not thinking about in terms of what's at greatest risk in terms of habitat and species. Particularly those that we're already focused on here, as endangered or threatened. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. I think one of the big challenges, obviously sea level rise and its impacts on coastal zones are going to be critical for all sorts of number of species and habitats. But one of the ones that, an area that, it's kind of an area that actually is surprisingly understudied is sort of the ecological impacts of drought on fish and wildlife species. We certainly know the effects of drought on humans, and we know especially in our arid west how limited we are with water at times. And as the Secretary said yesterday, I think the drought that's going on in California is the 14-year is one of the longest droughts in the 1,200-year history, geological history. So this is an event that we don't see a lot of. And what we don't know is how fish and wildlife species in places like the West, Arizona, southern Utah are going to respond and how they're going to change. So my background is a card-carrying fisheries biologist, and I always tease my bird friends that birds can fly and go somewhere else, but fish, unfortunately, outside of lungfish and a few others, can't get out of the water and walk anywhere. So you've got this combination of less water and warming water. In many cases, fish are cold-blooded creatures. Where are they going to go, and what are we going to do? Are we going to set up giant chiller units or some other way to manage the stream so that we have these things going on? But it's sort of, believe it or not, a fairly big void in our understanding. We know a lot, I said, as how water drought affects a lot of things, like agriculture and other things, but not as much about how it affects fish and wildlife species.
Is there research outside the U.S. In regions, for instance, that have suffered long drought or other conditions that might be illuminating?
Yeah, I think Australia actually has done a lot of this, and sort of they've seen, for those of you that don't know this, they've had a combination of water use and long-term dryness in things like the Murray-Darling Basin in Australia, where you get the salinization of soils. So you've got this soil that once held plants and other things that were it could have a nice ecological community and other things in it that now have become saline. And so sort of the native plants that were there and sort of the entire hydrological cycle has changed. And so it really is a place, in other parts of the world, I would say Australia is really been on the forefront of some of this understanding of what happens to long-term lack of water in sort of stream corridors, as it were.
Okay. Another question from the floor.
So this question is for Doug, Rachel Levin, Bloomberg BNA. I'm wondering what your department needs as far as what's missing and what priorities are going, are being swept under the rug, so to speak, and what could help resolve those issues?
Well, and the Secretary mentioned this yesterday, one of the things this administration has done is invested in the President's Climate Action Plan. And I think many of the bureaus within the department, including the survey, has been a part of that action plan. And in fact, in the 15 budget this year, the survey and I'm sure other parts of the Interior, which I don't know as well, had some asks from the President to try to increase some of their activity, science activity, along, I'm sure, with management activity with the other bureaus. So I think there's at least on one level, certainly we can always increase our base knowledge about a lot of things, and we should have known, for example, how much carbon biologically and geologically the United States had a potential for. So it was invested in a few years ago, and we're working on it. And that's, you have to start at base one. You have to know just basic level understanding. Another area that surprisingly we know little about is sort of the adaptive capacity of fish and wildlife species to climate. We know a lot about how sensitive they are, how long they can tolerate things, but we don't really know how they may evolve or how they may change. We do know, for example, we're going to get unique communities that are going to form that we've never seen before. We already see this somewhere, because some species will be able to adapt and stay in place, others will not. They will not be able to handle this. And so I think there's, you know, this is probably a good scientist thing to ask, that more science is needed. And of course, that's how we end every paper we write, at the last sentence is always more science is needed. But certainly there are a number of areas, just fundamental things that we don't really understand, that I think that the community, at least on the biological side, needs to really invest more time in.
We have time for one or two more. Okay, here and then there. Thanks.
Hi, I'm April Reese with Discover Magazine, and there's been a lot of talk here about feasibility and also urgency, and just looking big picture, stepping out for a second, I was just wondering if you could comment on how likely you think it is that these things, giving the investment challenges, all the challenges you guys have laid out so well, what are your thoughts about how likely it is that we're actually going to see these advances and this problem addressed in the very short time that we have?
Well, you know, there's a difference between trying to realistically assess that and having hope that you will. You know, the hope is something that you should always have, that we will do it and we should continue to try. But it's a daunting task. And the most optimistic scenarios from the IPCC are things that we're not on track for. We don't have a mechanism to deliver yet. And we don't have much time left. So I think it's, you know, in reality, the 2-degree issue is I personally think it's very unlikely that we're going to stay below 2 degrees. But I also think there's another issue with 2 degrees that you have to keep in mind, which is that sort of that's a human idea. The thing that we can control is our emissions, not the temperature that the Earth receives. We also have a lot of risk out there that something is going to happen that's not in those models, that there are nonlinearities or, you know, excursions that will happen. So and those are all on the bad side. There are not very many things on the side of, oh, we'll escape because some miracle will happen. Most of the ideas out there that will take excursions from what we're predicting are on the negative side. So I think it's unlikely. I think we have to plan as if it's not going to happen. We, you know, at least in terms of resilience, in terms of what we might do on climate engineering, we have to have research and plans and strategy for dealing with it at the same time that we should be trying very, very hard to achieve it.
Well, same kind of response. I mean, I don't know if I want to comment on how likely it is, but rather act to make it possible. It is, I mean, the adversity economically, politically is of course very strong. Without kidding yourself, you can also look at some of the positive signals that exist, and they're very true. I'm certainly not arguing that they have become mainstream, but they're here and they're trying to get organized to become mainstream pretty quickly. You don't necessarily see these signals at the government or, you know, at the country level, but lots of cities in particular or regions have taken emission reduction targets, are trying to get organized to put pressure on their own governments in the negotiations. What I said is, I think, very real. I mean, the fact that the investment community, at least part of it, maybe more in Europe than in the US so far, has become very aware of the issue. I also strongly encourage you, if you don't know about it, there is a think tank /NGO called Carbon Tracker. And they have really initiated a discussion in between the oil companies and the the investment community, and Moody's and people like that on the issue of stranded assets. So the fact that, you know, the way we value these companies is very dependent on oil being used eventually, but you know, if there is a price on carbon, if we become serious about climate mitigation, I mean, that's not real value for these companies. And there is a real discussion these days about some of these big oil companies and Moody's and Fitch. And so, yeah, lots of positive signals. Not yet winning the fight for sure, but we hope also that the negotiations in Paris are going to provide the catalyst for the different people to get organized.
One last question, but we'll have to keep it very brief, as will the answers, because we're a couple of minutes away from you.
Sure. Hi, my name is Daniela Capistrano. First off, I wanted to thank the panel for sharing their knowledge and insights. My question is related to Jane. You had brought up that when you're talking about geoengineering and climate engineering, all the many facets, it's like an elephant. And so since my focus is on covering this type of research for young people to make it more accessible, I was just wondering for the panel if maybe each one of you could name like one area of research or study that you wish more educators could be able to translate in accessible ways to young people in primary and secondary school, because this research, ultimately, we're going to be dead when all this stuff really affects people. And I want them to know what's going on. So if you could recommend what young people need to know and maybe some thoughts on how to make it more accessible as journalists. Thank you.
So while you're still alive.
Oh, wow.
Can we get a quick response from each of you? I think it's a good question. What area of research
would you educate? I think that what I really want people to understand is that we are now responsible for the future of our planet. That concept is, it's not just your local, you know, your local environment that you want to restore or protect, but that there's a new environmentalism that's needed, that's a global environmentalism that treats the whole system as the goal. Because we are stewards of the planet now, and there's no unintentional, you can't hide behind unintentionality anymore. We are changing the climate, we are changing the planet, and we are stewards of that planet. And so as a human species, we have a long way to go to learn how to do that intentionally and beneficially. And that's what I think the challenge of your generation and my grandchildren's generation is. How are you going to be stewards?
I'm not sure if that targets really the people you have in mind, but it's definitely something you can start doing at high school. I've done it. There is a pretty cool tool that's called the Global Calculator, and it has some country modules too. And it's a tool that helps you. You've got different options, so you can say, what if I do that? And you can type a particular type of action, and it gives you instantly the result for the climate, the economy of your country, the energy security of your country. I mean, it's pretty user-friendly, and it's a very good way of looking at what needs to be done, maybe not at the individual level, but more at the country level. So it's definitely useful, I think.
I'll be very brief. It's something I've told my two sons for a long time. The world will change. Better get used to it, and you better be able to adapt to it.
Well, let's give the panel a round of applause. Right. We are asked to go quickly to the ballroom. I'm sure the panelists will stay for a moment if you want to say hello or exchange cards. But thank you again to them from me for bringing so much knowledge to the discussion. Thanks for all of you, too, for your great questions.